Yarwood. I'm an infectious diseases physician, director of the statewide antimicrobial stewardship program. I'm one of the co-chairs of the statewide infection clinical network.
And hello, I'm Naomi Runniger. I'm also an infectious disease physician and a clinical microbiologist and the co-chair of the statewide infection clinical network.
Trent and Naomi, thank you both very much for taking the time to talk with the Queensland Clinical Senate today. You share the role of the chair of the statewide clinical infection network. When did the network begin?
Early in 2020, we've formally come into being. We felt there was some need for a network previously, but in the context of COVID, that became more pressing. And our community of practice was keen to come together and ensure we had, you know, an optimal response at the hospital level with respect to this important infection and work together on other infectious disease and infection control issues as well.
And Trent, what then was the role of the network during the pandemic response?
In the early days of the pandemic, we really didn't know what it was going to look like. You know, the projections were that things could have been terrible and that we would have been inundated with cases. So thankfully, it hasn't turned out like that. But a big driver for getting the network together is that we really wanted to have a coordinated response to the pandemic and to try and get some consensus in the way that things were done across the state and try and reduce the workload of all of our colleagues working in infectious diseases, infection control and microbiology, because we figured that they would probably all be very busy in, you know, doing their own jobs as part of the pandemic response. So we really wanted to try and make sure that we were reducing duplication of effort and that we really had consensus advice that was you know, representing what the best of what all of the state's infection professionals were thinking. We've been really involved in reviewing guidelines and assisting various parts of the department, and the HHS has come up with ways that we can improve how we look after people with COVID. And it's been quite a wild ride.
Trent, can you tell us a little about what it was like to be part of the response, particularly in the early days?
Lots of long days. As I said, we didn't really know what it was going to be like. You know, we'd seen what was happening in China, and it's really hard to make those sort of decisions in the setting of a lack of good information. And so we had to sort of prepare as well as we could while planning for the worst, while still doing all of our regular jobs. So it was interesting time. But, like I say, it's been hard work, but I think overall, I don't know that we've enjoyed every minute of it, but it's been a good experience to go through.
Naomi, the vaccine rollout has started in Queensland and across Australia. Did you expect that we would have such early access to an effective vaccine?
That's a really good question. And my honest answer to that is no. In the beginning, I was actually quite pessimistic about having early access to a vaccine. So, you know, really grateful to be in a position now, particularly in Queensland, where we're able to roll out the vaccine without having had any significant sustained community transmission and the sort of high mortality and morbidity that we've seen in other areas overseas. We're in a really privileged position to have the vaccine at this point. You know, historically, there have been problems with developing vaccines for coronaviruses. We don't have good vaccines for SARS or MERS, the other coronaviruses that are at the severe end of the spectrum that we've seen in humans in the last couple of decades. I'm very, very happy to have had my pessimism proven wrong and to have now have multiple different vaccines available and licensed, and we're already seeing real-world data from where they're being used overseas showing the impact on, preventing death and disease from COVID. So it's really great.
And Naomi, there are a lot of questions about the speed in which the vaccines have been developed and become available. How have they been developed so quickly?
Part of the reason was that very early access to the genome of the virus, which is historically it's taken a lot longer to get that information out there, but the technology on that side's become a lot quicker, so people could start working on a vaccine earlier. And then there is a lot of research going on all the time in vaccine development because it's such an effective way of preventing disease. And if we look back at a similar but smaller scale precedent, there was a significant large Ebola outbreak, for example, in 2014, where some of the regulatory barriers to vaccine development were, improved or removed to facilitate rapid vaccine development in the setting of a pandemic or epidemic, where a more rapid process would be beneficial. So, and I think the pressing need for vaccine in this context was recognised. So huge amounts of resources have been poured into doing that. And I think the other element, sort of a two-edged sword, is that in countries where the vaccines have been studied, because the infection rate has been so high in some areas, which is horrendous to watch from afar, the silver lining to that is we can measure the effectiveness of a vaccine very quickly. So there's lots of reasons, but I think also part of it is people recognising the pressing need and so putting so much work and effort into it. Another thing for which I'm really grateful that there's a lot of smart people out there that are able to do that.
Yeah, we're all very grateful, aren't we? And Trent, I think I heard you talk, use an analogy the other day of perhaps a truck moving through traffic around how we've been able to create the vaccine so quickly. Is that right?
I can't take any credit for it. It was actually Keith McNeil, the Deputy Director General, who told us in one of our meetings. But he said that the way the vaccine developed, if you think of normal vaccine development as like a float in a parade, where it sort of crawls down the street and people interact with the people on the float and they throw out lollies to kids or the dancers dance or whatever. But this vaccine development has been like a float driving at full speed down a completely empty road with a police escort. And, so the process is the same, but it's just all of the barriers have been removed. So it's not that anything's being done differently or less safely or in any, they haven't cut any corners. Mm-hmm. What they've done is just removed every single obstacle from getting the vaccine out as quickly as they possibly can.
And Trent, how safe are the vaccines and what is the efficacy?
Look, the vaccines are absolutely safe. In terms of information about how effective they are, we're still getting information, and that's one of the big advantages of us having the experience that Naomi was talking about of seeing the vaccine rollouts in other countries. We've seen what's happened to the patients who have been given the vaccine. We've got a chance to follow them up, and we're having a chance now in some countries to see whether those vaccines are effective in reducing the burden of disease and burden on the health system. So we know that all of the vaccines are effective at preventing people from getting seriously ill, and that's really the most important thing that we want to stop. We don't want people to get sick. From a systems point of view, we don't want our health system to be overwhelmed with large numbers of people who are sick enough that they're taking up all of their beds in ICU. The vaccines are all effective at doing that, some a bit more, some a bit less. There's some concern that there may, some of the vaccines may have different activity against different variants of COVID. But we know that that's always going to happen because viruses change over time. That's why we need to get our flu vaccine every year. And I don't think that means that any of the vaccines is better or worse. It's just they have different effects and that will continue to change over time. We are starting to get a little bit of information now that even though the original vaccine studies weren't really designed to look to see whether COVID transmission was reduced by the vaccines, we're starting to see from some of the countries overseas now that is indeed looking like it's happening. And so we're hopeful that not only will the vaccines be effective at preventing disease, but they'll also be effective at preventing spread. And they're an important part of what we can do to get everything back to normal. So we certainly encourage everybody, but especially healthcare workers, to get vaccinated as soon as they can.
What reactions can people expect from the vaccines?
Most people will have either no reaction at all or perhaps just a sore arm for a day or two. The usual sort of minor vaccine reaction. Sometimes people can feel a bit achy, even sometimes a low-grade fever, but that's very rare. But really the worst that most people can expect is a sore arm for a couple of days. And, you know, I had my vaccine on Friday last week, and so my arm was sore on Saturday, and then it was better by Sunday. So, you know, that's what most people, I think, could expect most of the time. The rates of severe reactions with these vaccines are very, very low. You know, for serious allergies, we think it's as few as maybe 4 cases per million vaccines given. So that's not to say there's not going to be any people who have a severe reaction, but overall it's going to be very small numbers, and most people won't have any problems.
And Naomi, have you had your vaccine as well?
I did. I had mine on Monday, so only 2 days ago.
And are you feeling relieved and excited to have had that first vaccine shot?
I'm certainly happy, being someone that sometimes goes into the ward to see patients with COVID, to have that extra layer of protection. I think it's great. And just to be part of the whole vaccination program that we're all participating in, I'm very happy that it's underway.
And Naomi, why are the dosing regimens different between Pfizer and AstraZeneca?
That's a good question. Mostly with the dosing regimens, we're relying on what's being studied. So what's been proven to be effective in the clinical trials, and the studies may select booster timing for different reasons. I mean, one thing we are starting to see now is that there is significant protection even from one dose of the vaccine. Some later studies with AstraZeneca, there was some variation in the timing of the booster, but what's been identified now is that those people that had their booster or their second dose later towards the 12-week mark over time did have a stronger antibody response. So that's why that is now the favoured time for the second dose of AstraZeneca. But all of the Pfizer studies were done with that 3-week interval.
And Trent, do you think we will need an annual COVID vaccine?
Look, I think it's really too early to say. We don't have all the information about how long the antibodies that the vaccines create will hang around. We would only be crystal ball gazing as to what might happen with COVID. You know, we could be so successful in squashing everything with the high uptake of the vaccine and all of our public health restrictions that we don't end up with very much COVID circulating in the community, and there may not be a need for an annual vaccine. But look, it certainly wouldn't be something that I would say would be impossible. You know, we may end up needing to have the vaccines annually. We know that flu changes enough that we need to do that, so we'll just need to wait and see. At the end of the day, I think that would be a small price to pay to try and avoid what's happened over the last year or two flaring up again.
I imagine this past 12 or so months has been incredibly busy for you both. What do you hope things will look like 12 months from now in March 2022?
Okay, I'd be optimistic that a large majority of our population will be vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that means we can start or move towards treating COVID-19 like the other respiratory viruses. You know, there might be some illnesses associated with that, but nothing like the horrible consequences we've seen overseas to date. And I would also be optimistic that in a year Australia will have assisted our near neighbours with their vaccine rollout as well, if that's required, because, you know, we're looking for global control to really effectively minimise the harm from this virus.
And Trent, what about yourself? Where do you see things or hope to see things in 12 months from now?
Look, I very much agree with Naomi, but I guess from a community point of view, what I really hope is that COVID will have gone away, but we won't have forgotten its lessons. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen just how effective staying at home and washing your hands and you know, being really mindful about going out when you're unwell has done to all of the other respiratory viruses in 2020. We know that it's the smallest season for influenza that we've seen in many, many years. So I'd be really hopeful that we could take some lessons from COVID and not just say, oh, well, we can go back to normal now and do everything like we used to do, and that people will be, you know, more diligent about their hand hygiene and maybe think about physical distancing a bit more in the community. And By March next year, I hope that we will have gotten over enough of the acute phase of the pandemic that we can really start putting into place all the lessons that we've learned from there will be another pandemic. Hopefully it won't be for another 100 years, like between the 1918 flu and this one. But there will be smaller ones, but, you know, in coming up in the future. And it would be really great if we could take everything that, that COVID has taught us and make sure that we respond quicker and better and you know, with less illness and less deaths next time.
Well, thank you both for everything you've done during the pandemic and congratulations on the network. And thank you both very much for joining the Clinical Senate today.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks very much for your time.